When to present a summary of the book of Daniel is always a problem to somebody who is trying to portray it. I wondered whether I'd start last week or whether I'll do it today or when I'll do it, and I've decided I'm going to do it right now. The book of Daniel can be divided into 14 parts, 7 prophecies and 7 stories. I like 7, that's why I've chosen 7, and they happen to fit in very nicely. 7 stories and 7 prophecies. The 7 prophecies tell you when, and the 7 stories tell you how. The 7 prophecies tell you when the coming of Jesus Christ will take place. The 7 stories tell you how you've got to react as you're preparing for that second coming. Now you know the book of Daniel. Just stands up and talks to you. I'd suggest that you go home and try to list those 7 prophecies. And if you agree with me, then I'll know you're smart. The 7 stories are not too difficult to line up. Now, if you can imagine the second coming of the person of Jesus Christ is the very center of an axle. The person of Jesus Christ. The bullseye. Around that person of Jesus Christ, if you drew a circle with another color and call that the second coming of Christ, and then surrounding that still another circle that you call the pre-second coming judgment of Jesus Christ. And then around that, you put the signs indicating the imminence of that coming. Now you've got the center, you've got the axle, you've got the hub. Draw 7 spokes. And each of those 7 spokes, now in the figure of speech, I'm going to twist it and call it a telescope. So each of those 7 spokes are like 7 telescopes. The perimeter is the prophet's time. And he looks down through one spoke of a telescope and he sees Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome, the disintegration of the Roman Empire, the signs of the coming, the pre-advent judgment, the second coming, and Christ. And in each of the 7 prophecies, this is the line that you take. Some emphasize one a little bit more than the other. So you've got a wheel. The rim of the wheel is the prophet's time. From that rim, moving like the spokes, 7 spokes of a wheel, come these 7 lines of prophecy, each of which concentrate on the pre-advent judgment, the second coming, and the person of Jesus Christ. Now in between those 7 spokes, there's 7 spaces. In each of those 7 spaces, write an appropriate story. Last week we thought about Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and their vegetarian diet, and the way the Lord Jesus Christ transformed their minds and made these simple Hebrew mutilated prisoners of war the smartest people in all Babylonia. So when the second coming of Christ is near, diet is a vital point. Make no mistake. Prophecies tell you when. Stories indicate how you've got to live when the when takes place. Of all the things that God might have told us when we're getting ready for the second coming of Christ, all the things, these are what He chose. That's what I love to do when I study the Bible. Turn to the book of Daniel and read chapter 2. Now we're going through Daniel 2 today in some detail. It's divided into 2 parts. The first 30 verses and the last 19. 30 and 19. Out of a 19, the prophecy is only a part. It's not all 19. 46, 47, 48, and 49, Nebuchadnezzar's reaction. Little inconsequential, I'm saying that tolerantly and ironically. Nothing is inconsequential in the Bible. But why, when we are given this tremendously important prophecy, do we have a prelude of 30 verses? What do you want to know anything about this chief of the executioners? Why do you need to know anything about Arioch? After all, Daniel 2, and if I said Daniel 2, you'd think of an image. The image is only part. Numerically speaking, word-wise, a small part. So I say to myself, now why has God done this? 30 verses of preliminary. And the real nub, the core, the pith of the prophecy is only a few verses, comparatively few verses. And I say to myself, if space indicates emphasis, what is God trying to emphasize? The stories in the book of Daniel occupy more space than the prophecies. God is trying to tell us that the how we should react is more important than knowing the theory of the when. That's what he's trying to tell us, as I understand it. How? So chapter 1, the first story, and he starts with a story, is a story covering diet. Man's relationship to the food that he should eat and should not eat. Very important, according to space. So store it up in your mind and think about it. Chapter 1 ends with the statement that Daniel, verse 20, in all matters of wisdom and understanding, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in his realm. The wisdom that God gave to these faithful young men was more profound and far-reaching and useful. Understanding, profundity, wisdom, utility. A wise man not only has knowledge, but he knows how to apply it. And in fact, it would be far more valuable to have a wise man with a little knowledge than a man with the Encyclopedia Britannica printed out in his brain and no wisdom. So Daniel not only had understanding, but he had wisdom. And if you turn to the 119th Psalm, you will get some idea as to why and how and through what means Daniel gained this knowledge. Psalm 119, verse 97 and following. Oh, how love I thy law! It is my meditation all the day. Thou, through thy commandments, hast made me wiser than mine enemies. They are ever before me. See, wisdom. I have more understanding than all my teachers, for thy testimonies are my meditation. To the law and to the testimony, through thy commandments and through thy testimonies. I understand more than the ancients, because I keep thy precepts. Quite an insight. More understanding, more wisdom, more insight. Why? Because of the point of view and the focus of reference. The law and the testimonies are his meditation. And so it is of Daniel and his three friends. They had more understanding than the ancients. They had more wisdom than the wise men of all Babylon. Because God's law and testimony were the directives and dynamics of their lives. Let's make no mistake about that. This is right at the beginning. Daniel focuses on the crisis at the close. As we read in Christ's statement in Matthew 24:15, when you read that which is spoken by Daniel the prophet, you read a book, Daniel the prophet, the one who reads, let him understand. And the first thing we understand from chapter 1, you live right, you eat right, you study the law and the testimonies, and God will fulfill His purpose and give you more understanding and more wisdom. In the second year of Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel 2:1, the king dreamed dreams wherewith his spirit was troubled, and his sleep brake from him. Beautiful way to tell us he had a nightmare. Nebuchadnezzar had a nightmare. And the king commanded to call all the magicians, the astrologers, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans. All right, what is a magician? A magician believes in magic. The very center of magic is that the hand fools the eye. Very sharp. Very manipulative. Point to something here and get somebody looking at this and pretending this, and you get around here and do something else and bring a rabbit out of their ear. Sleight of hand. Quick. Maneuvering. Magicians. Astrologers. Read the imaginary signs of the stars. Born in such a month, such and such a star influences you. The imbecility of the Babylonian astrologers is seen on every astrological chart and every newspaper in 1974. See, the breed of nitwits is not extinct. I don't want to humiliate any of you, but do you know what star you were born under? Don't tell me. I don't. I deliberately keep that stupidity out of my mind because I discovered when I was a kid I could remember the stupid much more quickly than the sane. And so when you want to buy a new suit of clothes, you say, do the stars shine upon my decision? So the astrologers are the people that play with the supposed influence of the stars on the thinking and acting of men. Now the sorcerers communicate with the dead, the occult, spiritualists. I really don't like that term. The spiritists. There's nothing spiritual about them. The sorcerers. They communicate with the dead. They try to get the dead, who didn't know anything when they were alive anyway, suddenly become smart. Amazing. I was giving Bible studies one time to a lady. She had quite an experience before she reached her status of mediumship. She had two guides. One was an American Indian chief, but always chiefs. I think 200 years ago there weren't any Indians. They were all chiefs. This was a chief. And the other one, also 200 years before, happened to be a Roman Catholic priest. And we presented the Sabbath to her, the change of the Sabbath, and showed from the catechisms of the Catholic Church the claims that the Sabbath had been altered by the Church from Saturday, the seventh day of the week, to Sunday, the first day of the week. She didn't tell me, but she told me afterwards. The next time she went into a trance and this priest came, she said to him, "Look, that fellow in such and such an auditorium is telling me this. Is it true or isn't it true?" And he told her, "Sure, it's true. We did." Now that was very interesting, I thought. Very interesting. The spirit must have been in the meeting and read the catechism. Because it certainly wasn't the spirit of somebody who had died 200 years before. But this communication with the dead, all Babylon 600 years before Jesus was born. So here you get the magicians, the astrologers, those who dabble in the occult, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans. Now the Chaldeans were a very close society of educated, wise men. As far as I can make out, they're the only ones that had any educational background and criteria for being judged wise. And Nebuchadnezzar decided he was going to get all kinds of wisdom from those who were sleight of hand, and from those who read the stars, and from those who communicated with the dead, and from those who were educated. He gathered them all together. In fact, these four represented all the brains. This was the brains trust of Babylonia. He had combed Harvard and Yale and Princeton and Berkeley. This was the cream of the cream. And the king said to them, "I have dreamed a dream and my spirit was troubled." In other words, I had a nightmare. And I want to know the dream. Then spake the Chaldeans unto the king in Syriac or Aramaic, "O king, live forever. Tell thy servants the dreams and we will interpret it." And the king said, "Didn't I tell you? I've forgotten it. The thing is gone from me. If you will not make known to me the dream with the interpretation, you shall be cut in pieces. And your houses made a dump." "But if you will show the dream and the interpretation, you shall receive of me gifts and rewards and great honor. Now get with it." That's in no translation yet. That's in my paraphrase. Then they answered again and said, "Let the king tell his servants the dreams and we will show the interpretation." And the king answered and said, "Now I know you're just stalling. You want to gain time. Because you see that I've forgotten it. If you will not make known, there's only one decree for you all. You've prepared lying and corrupt words to speak before me till the time be changed, till I think of something else. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can tell me the interpretation." Notice how he's moved. "You tell me the dream, and if you can tell me this dream, then I'll know you can interpret it." And the Chaldean said, "This is utterly unreasonable. There's no man upon the earth that can show the king's matter. Therefore, there is no king or lord or ruler who'll ask such things." That was a nice, snide way of saying, "You're out of your mind. There's no normal person that would ask this. The thing is rare, extremely rare, that the king requires. There is none other that can show these things except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh." For this cause, the king was angry and very furious, commanded to destroy all the wise men of Babylon, and the decree went forth that the wise men should be slain, and they began to look for Daniel and his companions. He was one of them. 13 verses. To what import? Now get this. With a noose round their necks, with a luger to the back of their skulls, with the blade of the guillotine just waiting on a hair, the wisest men in Babylon to save their necks couldn't tell the king what had transpired 4 hours before. And yet claimed to tell him what lay ahead. You know what the Lord's trying to tell us? That the smartest men in the world know nothing. They can't tell you what happened yesterday, but they can tell you everything that's going to happen tomorrow. And I used to drive from Napa to Vallejo, or Oakland, down south from Angwin. The road passes a little cottage on the right. If you've driven down it, you've seen it. In front of that cottage is a hand. Advice given, palmist. And every time I look at that house and the yard and the state in which it is, I say to myself, Madam X, you need advice. If the best that you can do winds you up in that dump, you can't do anything for me. Now these men, to save their lives, couldn't tell him a thing. And then they found Daniel, and Daniel says in verse 14, notice the way it's put. Daniel answered with counsel and wisdom to Arioch, as the margin indicates, the chief of the executioners of the king's guard, which was gone forth to slay the wise men. He answered and said unto him, why is the decree so hasty? In other words, what's the hurry? You know, I think if a man had a sword on the back of my neck, I too might say to him, what's the hurry? Anything for 5 minutes more. What's the hurry? Daniel was a wonderful fellow. Smooth, understanding, played it cool. What's the hurry? And his gentle voice, Arioch tells him the story, and he says, well, just give me time. Let's have a prayer meeting. I got three buddies here, and the Lord can tell us. And so Arioch, just like Melzer had taken a fancy to this young man, Arioch took a fancy to him. He says, while I'm collecting the rest of it, you go pray. And so Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego have a prayer, and then you read their prayer. Verse 18, they would desire mercies of the God. And Daniel answered and said, blessed be the name of the Lord, verse 20 and verse 21 and verse 22 and verse 23. And meantime, you're waiting to get into Daniel 2. And you've now gone through 23 verses. And you haven't got anywhere near it yet. You've got to get from 24 to 31. Now what happens? Daniel says, Arioch, it's fine. But the king, no, I think I can help him. God's told me. And Arioch cleans the front of his shoes and the back of his trousers and makes certain that all the dust is off and swells his chest and goes to Nebuchadnezzar. He says, I found a man. I found a man. He can do exactly what you want. Arioch had found zero. But this kind of bureaucrat always tries to step on somebody else's value, virtue. And Nebuchadnezzar called Daniel in, whose name was Belteshazzar, and asked him in verse 26, are you able to make known to me the dream which I have seen and the interpretation thereof? And Daniel says, I can't. The secret which the king has demanded, the wise men cannot, the astrologers and the magicians and soothsayers, but there is a God in heaven. There is a God in heaven that revealeth secrets and maketh known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. I didn't do it. The dream and the visions of thy head upon thy bed are these. As for thee, O king, thy thoughts came into thy mind upon thy bed. What should come to pass hereafter? See, Daniel is looking back into that night and he says, king, you went asleep and you were thinking what is going to be in the future. It's going to be in the next generation. Built up this great kingdom of Babylon. What's going to happen next? Will it last? Will it be overthrown? He that revealeth secrets maketh known unto thee what shall come to pass. As for me, this secret is not revealed to me, for any wisdom I have more than any living person. But for their sakes that shall make known the interpretation to the king. So God's plan. That thou mightest know the thoughts of thy heart. 30 verses have gone by. 30 verses. Almost two-thirds of the whole important part of this chapter. What is God telling us? First of all, He's telling us that the wisdom of the world is utterly useless when it comes to explaining and looking into the future. Point number one. The smartest men in the world's brain trust can't tell you what happened last night, let alone tell you what's going to happen tomorrow. Second, God has got people through whom He is ready to reveal His secrets to men. He's got His people. They're not the most honored. They may not even be very old. Daniel was just 21 years of age. 20 maybe. Just a young fellow coming from a foreign country, speaking Chaldee with a foreign accent. But his relationship with God was right. Now notice the stringent circumstance in which this contrast was revealed. To save their necks, they couldn't tell it. There's no fooling about this. Now the world today claimed to be all kinds of leaders and wise and brains trust and think tanks and all the rest of it. We've gone to the moon, we can solve everything. They can solve nothing that's really important. That's getting out of this world alive. That's understanding what tomorrow is going to hold. But God is ready to reveal to simple, trusting believers who will pray all that they need to know. This prayer meeting is vital. Three young fellows, parents killed, future destroyed in an alien land, prisoners of war, forced in this situation, pray. God suddenly unfolds to them His infinitely wise and thrilling truth. Humble, childlike, trusting faith. Not in me. Not in me. God is revealing what shall be in the hereafter. Now for the dream. Thou, king, sawest, and behold, a great image. This nightmare consisted of a human form. And just imagine in your mind's eye a great image of a human being. And the brightness stood before thee, and the form was terrifying. The image's head was of fine gold. His breasts and his arms were of silver. His belly and his thighs were of brass. His legs were of iron, and his feet were reinforced concrete. Part of iron and part of mud. So the history of man is compressed in the image of a man whose head is gold, breast and arms of silver, middle of brass, legs of iron, feet of iron and clay. The golden, silver, brass, iron, and concrete ages cover the whole history of man. Now, if you don't think that's a condensed story of human history, try to find something more condensed. Now, I think at this point, Nebuchadnezzar's chin hit his chest with a hollow clonk. His mouth was wide open. He remembered his nightmare. Thou sawest till a stone was cut out of a mountain without hands. It smote the image on the feet of iron and clay and brake them into pieces. Then was the iron, the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold. This is the reverse order. Became like the chaff of a summer's threshing floor. The wind carried them away. No place was found for them. And the stone that smote the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. Here in five verses, 3,500 years of history are condensed. From Daniel's age through the Christian age, beyond the second advent of Christ, beyond the millennium, until the stone fills the whole earth as one unified kingdom. This is the dream. You know, if I know anything about it, I think Daniel was enjoying himself. It was obvious that the king recognized the dream and by his expression indicated a validation of what Daniel was telling him. This is the dream. We'll tell the interpretation thereof before the king. Thou, O king, art a king of kings. The God of heaven hath given thee a kingdom, power and strength and glory. Whithersoever the children of men dwelt, the beasts of the field, the fowls of heaven, hath he given into thy hand, and hath made thee ruler of them all. Thou art this head of gold. So in this nightmare image, Babylon is the golden head. The king wondered what's going to happen afterwards. That's what Daniel says. As for thee, O king, thy thoughts came into thy mind upon thy bed, what should come to pass hereafter? That's verse 29. Now he answers, verse 39, and after thee shall arise another kingdom, inferior to thee, as silver is inferior to gold. And then a third kingdom of brass shall bear rule over all the earth. And then there will be a fourth kingdom, as strong as iron. I think of prophecy many times, and the interpretation there of prophecy is like surveying. You've got to start at some fixed point. If you're trying to get altitudes, draw contours, you've got to start at some fixed level. Next time you go up to Pacific Union College, when you climb up from the library and across the end of the mall, there are some steps leading up to Columbia Hall. Why did I call it Columbia Hall? Irwin Hall. I'm mistaking colleges. Irwin Hall. As you go up the stairs, right on the first landing, if you look around, you will find a brass plate embedded in the cement. Tells you the altitude. 666 with a 1 in front of it. Must be some significance, wasn't there? It's 1,666 feet above sea level. Right there at the foot of Irwin Hall. Now once you've got that fixed, and other points you can survey anything. You can survey the top of Mount Everest without ever getting there. You've got fixed points. Thou art this head of gold is fixed. Now after thee shall come another kingdom. Now what is that other kingdom? Hold your finger here and turn to the 8th chapter of the book of Daniel. And you'll have it named in verse 20. Under a different symbol, but the name. The last three words, Media and Persia. That's the next one. The end of chapter 5. The last two verses. In that night was Belshazzar, the king of the Chaldeans, Babylonia, slain, and Darius the Median took the kingdom. So when Babylon fell, the Medes and the Persians took over. Then there's going to be a third kingdom that shall rule over all the earth. That's named in Daniel 8, verse 21. Grecia. And the Greeks defeated the Persians. Took over all their territory practically. Ruled over all the world. Then there should be a fourth kingdom. Now that fourth kingdom obviously is Rome. That shall rule strong as iron. As iron breaketh in pieces and subdueth all things, as iron that breaketh, shall it break in pieces and bruise. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided. Now I know there's a discussion in some expository circles trying to find the 10 divisions of the Roman Empire. There probably were 10 at periods. But you know, when I look at my feet each morning when I finish showering and dance on the weighing machine, I see my legs end in 10 little sprouts, 5 on each foot. How many of you concur with me? You know, that's the natural ending of humanity if you start with its head. And so what I think this prophecy is trying to tell us is that when man starts petering out, he'll just peter out just as a man peters out. And if you look at each foot petering out, there are 5 on each. So I've never tried to be specific about those 10. Now I think you can if you select your year. But give 10 years and they're 11. And give 25 years and they're 9. And so on down through the end. The 10 horns lend some credence to the fact that there may be some specificity to this. But I found it very difficult to be specific, and so I'm not going to try. What God is trying to tell us, Babylon is the head of gold, after him shall come an inferior kingdom, which is called Median Persia, after it will come a third kingdom, still more inferior, called Grecia, after it will come a fourth kingdom that shall be strong and battering, which is Rome, and when Rome falls, it will peter out into disintegrated fragments. In it, there'll be some of the strength of iron, and some of the weakness of the mud. And then as the toes and the feet were part of iron and partly, the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly brittle. And whereas thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with miry clay. Now let's stop and look at this for a few minutes. Kingdoms, empires, nations very seldom fall when they are weak. But when they are strong. Strong. You look over history and realize that. They won tremendous victories. They are masters of the world. They slowly disintegrate and give up. How did Babylon fall? 200 years before its fall, God said a man called Cyrus, one of two men in Bible prophecy that has been named by name 150 years before he was born, that he would deflect the waters of the river Euphrates, and he would find the two leaf gates open, and he would take Babylon. Belshazzar is king of Babylonia. He looks out and there's Cyrus riding his horse. And what is Cyrus doing? Digging a hole. And what's he going to do in the hole? He's going to empty the Euphrates. And all the Jews remember the prophecy. And all the Babylonians get scared. So what does he do? He has a propaganda dinner party. He doesn't care two hoots. And in fact, he set up a competition. See who could hold the most liquor. We'll deal with this in detail when we get to the chapter. That night, nobody was at the gates. They were drunk. The only person killed was Belshazzar. The armies of Cyrus just entered and killed the king. Just as simple as that. Cyrus had been named in Isaiah twice, told exactly what he would do. Nobody believed him. Persians, fat with victory, overloaded with booty, eaten up by a few Greeks. Alexander the Great is a world conqueror. Do you know how big his army was? 10,000 men. Do you know what he told those 10,000 men? I give you nothing. You fend for yourself, but you follow me. They fed themselves, they clothed themselves, they bivouacked themselves, they did everything themselves. And they bit off the Persians and chewed them up and spat them out and stomped on them. Incredible, isn't it? And then it was their turn. And a few cohorts of the Romans took care of them when they knew all the answers. And when Rome was mighty and had its pearl fishers in Scotland and its spice gatherers in India and its armies bestraddling Africa and Europe, the hairy ones took care of them. You know what a barber is? In this age, I think some people have forgotten. Barber has to do with hair. He's a cutter of hair. A barbarian is a long-haired one. That's the meaning of barbarian. Look up an etymological dictionary. And the Romans like short hair. So everyone who wasn't a Roman was a long-haired one, so he was a barbarian. I've had some students who were. The barbarians just came in and destroyed them. Unorganized, poorly armed. But the others were too fat and self-satisfied. They loved their saunas and swimming pools far too much. The whole Roman Empire collapsed. And then the prophet looks and says, some parts of it are iron and some parts of it are mud. They're partly strong and they're partly brittle and they go on like this. And they try to mingle themselves so they might get strength. And we look over history and they tried to mingle themselves many times. Many times. I think of the attempt made the last time by Hitler. History repeats itself. Guns, not butter. Total mobilization. Best drilled army in the history of armies. A little while they had overrun the Maginot Line, they had overcome Belgium, they had attacked and taken Holland, they had pushed the expeditionary force to Dunkirk. And there across the channel was British Isles. Poised to take it. The generals were ready to liquidate that expeditionary force, 450,000 mixed soldiers. Churchill called for the boats and rowed them across. I happened to see them in the trains. They were right in my district. I traveled the trains every day. There was no gasoline. Full of people that had come from Dunkirk. Hadn't slept for weeks. Lay down in the train. Went to sleep right there. Some of them terribly burned. All of them disheveled. All of them filthy. And then came the Battle of Britain. Hundreds and hundreds of planes over a tiny little area. Bomber after bomber. blood and fire and destruction. The British Air Force sent up the Hurricanes and the Spitfires. Hurricanes and Spitfires. Some days when 187 German planes were shot down in an area smaller than Los Angeles. I had bits of aeroplanes. I've still got some in my garage now. Pick them up. Bits of shrapnel. Twisted, burned. Heinkels and Dorniers kept on coming. And Spitfires and Hurricanes kept on meeting them. Air Vice Marshal Park was in charge of this down in Surrey. And Churchill went down to see him one day in September 1940. All afternoon and evening he watched as the WAFs put the little counters that indicated where the radar said the Germans were coming and where the interceptors went up to meet them. Wave after wave of bombers. Wave after wave of interceptors. Tension high. Everyone silent. Churchill turns to Park and says, "Park, how many more have you got?" Park says to him, "Sir, I put in my last." And they waited and waited, and Goering had put in his last. With tears in his eyes, he got into his limousine to be driven back to number 10 Downing Street, and on the way back, he thought of that immortal phrase of the debt owed by so many to so few. Few. Spitfires. Hurricanes. In the great fly past of the Battle of Britain that takes place every year, for years after the Second World War, the last two, one Spitfire and one Hurricane, led all the great bombers and fighters that came behind them. Until they became, like Grandpa, a little too slow, the jets would have eaten them. They couldn't throttle back to stay behind them. And so they put them in mothballs. If you care to go, you can see the last two that were left. The so few. September 1940 was the time, sometime between the 16th and the 20th of September, when Britain was to be invaded. Why? The tides are flat. The gales are down. The skies are clear. The English Channel is calm. Men and women try to swim it in that month. For the first time in living memory, on the 17th of September, a gale sprung up. The invasion barges had to take refuge in the harbors, and while fighter command had been shot out of the sky, bomber command pasted them. Then the invasion was postponed to November 1940, under cover of the fogs. That's the fog month. 1940, there were no fogs. Nobody could remember any time. The next invasion date was in February 1941, 4 days before the invasion was due, a submarine subsidence in the northwest Atlantic raised tidal waves up the English Channel and up the North Sea that battered those invasion barges into uselessness. Then Hitler turned eastward, and what began was the end of the beginning and the beginning of the end. Years went by. United States entered the war. The invasion was planned. All the bunkers were built from the end of the Cherbourg way up to the Hook of Holland. Somewhere there, the Allies were going to attack. Hitler had built an autobahn a few miles inland. He had two crack panzer divisions. He alone, of all the German generals, was to order it in. United States Secret Service, all sorts of representatives in Switzerland, other sounding posts working on the personal habits of the leaders of the German army. Hitler went to bed at 2 o'clock. He got his breakfast at 9 in bed. Nobody was to awake him between 2 and 9. He ate it, read his dispatches, and got ready for everything, dressed, shaved, his valet would take care of him. At 12 o'clock, he would meet his generals. He would talk with them till 3 when he ate his midday meal. He'd talk till 5, he'd rest till 7, he'd dress from 8 till the time he went to bed. He had his generals around him, inflexible. 2 o'clock he went to bed. Eisenhower ordered the invasion at 2:30. All leave had been cancelled. Rommel was in charge of the defense. His wife lived in Bavaria, and like, I suppose, most wives, she had a birthday. She invited him home. He hopped his little plane and flew just a few miles to Bavaria. And while he was there drunk, the invasion started. On his way back, he died. Accident? Suicide? Who knows? Speidel, Rundstedt, Keitel. Daren't send these two panzers into the attack without Hitler's specific order. Nobody could waken him before 9. He didn't believe it till his generals came in at 12, and it took them until 2 o'clock to persuade him that this was not a feint, as Dieppe had been. And when he ordered the panzers to fight, their teeth had been drawn. They were powerless. And we had entered the beginning of the end. The two-leave gates were open. The generals were drunk in their very zenith of power. They shall not cleave one to another. You know, you can go back in history and check this every time. Now, there's another message to this. I like to read this, and this is an Adventist commentary, volume 4, page 1164. We have come to the time when God's sacred work is represented by the feet of the image in which iron was mixed with miry clay. This is the dual application. The mingling of churchcraft and statecraft is represented by the iron and the clay. Churchcraft and statecraft. This union is weakening all the power of the churches. This investing the church with the power of the state will bring evil results. Men have almost passed the point of God's forbearance. They have invested their strength in politics. They have united with the church, universal. And the time will come when God will punish those who have made void his law, and their evil work will recoil upon themselves. Every specific of this prophecy has been fulfilled. Now Daniel sees a stone. That stone is Christ. 1 Corinthians 10:4. The stone which the builders rejected, untouched by hand. Look up your concordance for rock and stone. It's the same word in many contexts. This stone, untouched by hand, strikes the image on the feet and reduces clay, iron, brass, silver, gold to verse 35, to the chaff of a summer's threshing floor. What time of the harvest do you get chaff? After the threshing. It's been harvested. It's been threshed. The good seed has been sacked, ready for the barn. The chaff is cast out. The clay, the iron, the brass, the silver, and the gold, like the chaff at the end of a harvest, driven away. No place found for it. And the stone becomes a great mountain, kingdom, and fills the whole world. Forasmuch, verse 45, as thou sawest the stone, the God in heaven, verse 44, will set up his kingdom, which shall never be destroyed. It shall not be left to other people. Babylon left his to the Medes and Persians, who left theirs to the Greeks, who left theirs to the Romans, who left theirs to the barbarians, where at the end the end. Next time you stand on the scales and look at your toes, your body is finished. That's the end. There's nothing beyond. And this stone becomes a kingdom and fills the whole world. There is no prophecy written in any literature as explicit and irrefutable as Daniel 2. Like a mighty searchlight, this prophecy shines from the ancient days, gleaming on the gold of Babylon, shimmering on the silver of Persia, glinting on the brass of Greece, shining off the iron of Rome, throwing into lurid relief the divisions of the Roman Empire in modern Europe and Western world today. And as we look at it, the light pierces the gloom that lies ahead and focuses on the face of the Son of Righteousness, the Rock of Ages, who comes to establish a kingdom that shall never be moved, that shall fill the whole earth and not be given to another people. The God of heaven has told us what shall be in the hereafter. The dream is certain, the interpretation thereof is sure. And he who prayed and read the testimonies and kept the law and trusted God understood. Whoso readeth, let him understand. We have seen that spoken by Daniel the prophet come to pass. We are to understand. We live in the remnant of time, the end of the harvest, the beginning of the kingdom of God. Let's pray. Eternal Father, we thank thee for the wonder of prophecy, that it doesn't guess, it knows. We thank thee for the certainty of this word, for the light of thy truth. And as we think, we adore, we praise, we worship, we submit ourselves to thee. Make us subjects of that kingdom now. Help us to serve thee and follow thee all our lives. And when the kingdoms of this earth become the kingdoms of the Lord and of his Christ, may we each one be there to glorify thee. Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
This has been another classic sermon from the Archive of American Christian Ministries. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette or reel-to-reel in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright, American Christian Ministries. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.